On today's show, we continue our position preview during our catcher month. We talk undervalued Seattle Mariners catchers for 2024 drafts. Plus, we have our strategy section, injury report, which includes Jacob DeGrom, and trivia. And welcome to another episode of Beat the Shift podcast presented by FanGraphs. I am your host, Ariel Cohen, and as always, with me is Ruben Guy. We have a fantastic guest to preview Mariners catcher. My first choice was Mikey Jato, but he was busy possibly painting his nails or something like that. So we have Todd Hoppe. That's a cool name, Todd Hoppe. How you doing?
Thanks, Ariel. I'm doing great.
Hey, what's going on? Okay, so Todd Hoppe, you are a very good draft champions player and fantasy baseball player in the NFBC. You've been on the show before. You have two main event victories. You've done a lot of DCs. You've won 13 of them. Your cash rate is very high. So yeah, how you doing? Do you want to say where you're from on Twitter, or you want to skip that part?
No, I'm not worth following on Twitter. I don't tweet out all of my draft picks as we go. So not really a useful follow. But yeah, I mean, I'm in three drafts now. I've got 10 down so far. So if nothing else, I am always drafting at NFBC.
Yeah, you can say you're always, well, never mind. So that gets right to the housekeeping items. So yeah, let's talk about those analysts tweeting every pick of theirs. Like I'm seeing on Twitter, this might be my biggest pet peeve on Twitter right now. Is like I'm up because I'm always in drafts with like a lot of the notable analysts, and I'm in one with like I think I'm one with Frank and Amaranta or Frank whatever his name is and Amarante, like Bubba and all those guys, Matt Williams, Mason, and like Frank is tweeting every single pick he's making. And it's like, I don't know what the, like, I know he knows it's a joke by now, but it's like, is it like confirmation bias? You just want people to like your pick? Like, what if you're going to pick someone else? You got a snipe. Were you going to tweet? Like, why aren't you tweeting with that guy? Like, I don't get it. Like, it's just,
I mean, maybe what if it's, you think it's just like practice for TGFBI? Like you got to work that muscle, right? You don't want to jump right into TGFBI tweeting out all your picks. You got to practice before you do it.
That's right. That's right. It's like almost you don't need to even share your draft board. I can know your draft by just your tweets.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing I've seen is like everyone Twitter has to retweet the same thing. Like I see Brian Bello practicing with Pedro Martinez, and somebody retweets it, and then somebody else has to like, okay, this guy did it, so I'm going to say what I think about it. So it's like, you guys got nothing original to say at all, like. Just everyone's like, if like, oh, I see somebody talking about this, I'm going to talk about it now. Guess what? I've seen it. I've seen everyone talk about the same fucking thing.
Like, I think it helps if you add the eyes emoji to it, and that like really helps it blow up. No, I don't know. I mean, it is like, maybe this is a more serious rant than you want, but like it is sort of indicative of where like fantasy baseball is right now, where we all kind of have access to like 99% of the same information. And so then it becomes like in some ways an echo chamber of like the same stuff just kind of bouncing around and people kind of putting their like tacking their thoughts onto it as they you know, sort of bounce it around the room. But then it becomes like the game itself sort of shifts into this meta analysis of trying to figure out like what of it is meaningful, or when people are saying stuff, even if they're telling the truth or not, right? Or if it's all kind of a distraction from what they actually think. So I don't know. I agree. It is sort of an interesting phenomenon, kind of specific to Twitter, although you can kind of see it in other places too, right?
Oh, for sure. And it's like, it's so, everyone is like, it's so incestuous in the baseball and especially NFBC. There's a lot of people in the same draft. You're drafting the same people. Everyone's reading the same info, like you said. And everyone's just like sort of doing the same thing. I think like this year, I'm trying not to like look at any as much as I can, even though like you're on Twitter and you're, it's fun because you get to bust people's balls on there and you get whatever. It's fun to be there, but like it's, at the same time, I don't want to hear what people have to say because I think there's such an edge to be gained if you have your own sort of methods.
And you start to see that. You start to see that a little bit more with, you know, the success of some guys. Like, I mean, say what you want about the guilds, but like that guy, you know, goes to the beat of his own drummer, right? I don't think he actually does listen. If he does pay attention to a lot of the same stuff or pay attention to projections or whatever, he certainly does a good job of filtering it through his own lens, right? And taking a unique approach. I think that's one way that you can sort of differentiate yourself in some of these drafts when we're all kind of following the same ADP and all following, you know, we all see the same projections. We all see the same analysis. At that point, you got to figure out something that works for you in terms of getting some sort of edge, or else you're just drafting the exact same teams as everybody else.
Well, yeah, last year I was talking to my friend Mark Winoker, and he said that there used to be an edge with using projections like Steamer. And now that edge is like virtually disappeared. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that's paraphrasing what he said. Just on a side note, in terms of your prep, like what do you, when you're building a team, like say in a DC, what are you using, like SGP? Are you using projections? Or what are you working with?
You know, I've tried in the past to use like, you know, some of these SGP sheets are really fancy now, right? And I've tried to use that before, but I think it can be misleading in terms of it gives you sort of a sense of false precision to put a number for every single player and then an ordinal rank for all of them. And like, it is good, I think, in theory to be able to quantify the value of, you know, what is the value of Luis Arraez's batting average to your roto team, right? It's valuable to know that. I think it's less valuable to put an exact number on it and then put it in a spreadsheet and order them, because then it just becomes a distraction of like, when I'm building my team, I have to kind of ignore, you know, let's say I have conditional formatting on, I have to ignore that big green light on Arraez, for example, if I don't actually think that it's, you know, valuable for my team or that it's going to work within the context of a season. Because, I mean, these projections, like the last time I was on, we talked about this a little bit, but projections are like full season projections, right? And so you actually have to set your lineup week by week and think about how that's going to work. And within the framework of that, like, how do you move up the standings? I think putting a value on each of these specific contributions, I think people envision it giving them more value to themselves as a drafter than it actually does. Cause I think it's just as likely to kind of mislead you because you've got this number in front of you and you sort of treat it as, oh, that's the value of this guy. There's so much more uncertainty for each of these players and so much more, you know, variance around the stats that they'll actually provide and the shape of those stats that it seems kind of silly to me to use a sheet. So, I mean, typically, I don't know. I mean, I'll jump into drafts and then have some idea already of what I want my roster construction to be, like in DCs, right? And already have sort of a thought process for that. And then as you go through it, just thinking about, you know, there'll be certain players that I know I don't want a share of, but a lot of them, it'll just be, you know, I'll look at it and say, all right, you know, I'm into that guy, and then do a deeper dive on the players themselves, right? I think that's what I love about the DCs and that I've had some success doing is like, you know, your pick is coming up. There's, a list of guys on the board. You kind of look at the ADP and just dive on those guys and say, you know, these are the guys I'm interested in.
Right. And I'm trying not to listen to a lot of outside sources this year. But I was listening to a podcast recently, and they said that Marcus Stroman, he's like a volume guy. So you can get him for volume in these 15 team leagues. But like at the same time, like look at where, like you said, it's like projections, like, don't work throughout the season. So, but you got to think about how are you going to be using this player? Like if you're taking a guy near like pick 250 to 300, you're going to be streaming him in and out of your lineup. So like a guy like Stroman, like, and if you're using him, like maybe he's not a volume guy anymore, but like, if you're using him, in drafting him because of that, like, you're not really getting all those like wins and strikeouts because you're going to be taking him in and out of your lineup anymore. So I think there's diminishing returns to those, that type of profile, like maybe a profile like a Musgrove or a Logan Webb profile might be, okay, that makes sense early on because they're basically never coming out of your lineup.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. And obviously, like, the later you get in the draft, the projections, you know, really, I think, start to fall apart. And then, I mean, I think it's useful to look at it and say, like, okay, here's roughly how many home runs I have and how many steals I've got and where I'm at in batting average. But then other than that, you know, it's much more trying to combine that with sort of a holistic view of, like, all right, how does all this fit together and how do I actually set my lineup once the season starts, right?
Right. All right. Well, we've sort of gone off on a tangent. I got more housekeeping items I got to go through. So I, like, speaking of being on Twitter, I'm looking at all this stuff that I probably best serve not to. Joey Rico has a tweet. Goes, so much value in ADP 150 to 250 in outfield. And then he lists literally 11 of the 23 possible outfielders in that ADP range. So I think people are just I love when people just tweet out like mass things like, oh, I love all these players. Like, these are good players to pick. But you're listing like fucking like half of the answer key to what you could possibly do. So really, like, oh, like five of these people worked out. Great, congratulations. Like, what are you trying to prove here? What's the point?
I think the key is just refer to it as a pocket of value, and then I think everybody will be like, oh, okay, I get it.
But you know what? I don't disagree with him. I think that is a nice pocket of value. He's not the only person to mention that. Another thing I've noticed is it's a pretty slow time. People aren't even signing. Like, there's a lot of free agents still out there. Like, I'm waiting on free agency to pick up here, but like, I think everyone is. Everyone's just like waiting for news. And Jeff Zimmerman writes, mining the news. And I think that it's turning into, again, mining the opinions, not mining the news. So I'm looking at, I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, and I glance over it, and I'm like, oh, Dodgers 6-man rotation. I'm like, okay, cool. So I message some of the guys I talked to. I know they're like into glass now, and I'm like, oh, you see this Dodgers 6-man rotation stuff. You've got to be careful with that. And then they're like, yeah, you know, whatever. I still like the Dodgers pitchers. I'm like, okay, cool. Yamamoto still should be like a coveted guy. But then I didn't actually click on the article. And then like a couple of days later, I'm like, okay, let's click on this. Let's dig into this. So I click on the article, and it says, like, it basically copied what they said. It's a link to the Athletic article. Forget the guy's name that wrote the article, but he's like not even a beat writer. He's a writer at the Athletic who writes about the Dodgers, and he barely writes about the Dodgers as it stands. I think his name's like McLaughlin or something. I don't know. And then you click on the article. He's got like no other articles. Basically, what he says is, he's like I think the Dodgers might do a 6-man rotation because like Bueller's hurt, which is sort of false logic. Bueller might not start the season, so he might not even be in the rotation. So it's more of a reason for a 5-man rotation. But that's besides the point. Miller's young. Yamamoto's not used to the USA. Who else is there? Who else is in the top of the rotation? I forget right now. You got Yamamoto, Bueller, Miller, Glasnow's injury history, which is like, is it an injury history? Like, he just had Tommy John, so like, he should be okay. Anyways, he's saying all this stuff, and he's like, the Dodgers worked with a 6-man rotation last year, and he went into, if you peel it back, he starts looking at all their top starters from last year, like Kershaw, Urias, all these guys, and he lists like how many times they started on regular rest or more than regular rest. More than regular rest would be more than 4 days. But the thing is, Dodgers have off days. So anytime there's an off day, it's going to make it seem like they're on more than regular rest. So I went to Baseball Reference and I looked, and it's like the Dodgers run a 5-man rotation like fucking most of the year. Like, they went to a 6-man rotation near the end when they got Lance Lynn, not even for all of it. So like, first of all, this is just some fucking schmuck's opinion from The Athletic. Is meaningless. Second of all, his logic is faulty, but then you peel it back and you rewind back to Jeff Zimmerman's article, and it says the Dodgers are going to a 6-man rotation. So really, it's like mining the bad opinions, not mining the news. So you got to be careful. You got to really click on the articles and read it for yourself and make your own conclusions.
Yeah, that's all well said. I think, you know, the only point I'll add is that you and I both clearly agree that Walker Buehler is the steal of draft season.
Yes. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we don't want to talk about players. This is a Teach a Man to Fish podcast, but I will give you one name, and that's Walker Buehler. I would draft him with confidence. What else is there? Okay, I saw somebody sent me this. I didn't come across it, but there was a pitcher list article today about why Acuña might not be the number one pick.
You didn't read the article? Did you read the article? Because I looked at it, and it looks like it just quits halfway through. It's like it gives you Acuña analysis, it gives you Bobby Witt analysis, and then it just kind of ends. So I don't understand the point of that article at all. I mean, it's not a new concept, right? Because Ron Chandler did this for years, where he was like, oh, here's why all the first round picks will bust, right? It's the kind of thing that's sort of an interesting thought, I guess, on the surface, but it's not actually that meaningful when you start to think about it, because it treats it as like a deterministic process instead of probabilistic, in terms of, especially if you're in a snake draft, you know, I don't get to choose how much I allocate to my first round pick. Like, I get a first round pick, I got to take a guy, right? Yeah. So I don't actually care, like, what are the chances that Acuña is the number one player this year? I don't think I care, because all I care about is he the most likely to be the number one player? Or maybe if I'm doing a ton of drafts and I want to change my KDS to move around to not get, in theory, 100% Acuña or whatever, then maybe it's interesting. But beyond the surface, I don't even think it's a very interesting question or thought anymore.
No, it's not. It's a waste of time, especially this year. Like, maybe if you're talking about an auction, like, I'm looking at this article, and I wish I never read it, to be honest. But I'm looking at it, and I'll read you the part about Witt. And it's like, this is like, okay, they're like, okay, Acuña is really good. They listed all the things that are really good about Acuña that everyone knows. And then, like, take away auctions just for a moment, because, like, yes, you can draft Acuña and you can go stud heavy studs, which is not really, like, you're not going to draft. You're really unlikely to take Acuña and, like, J-Rod in an auction. Even. That's like, it's going to be very difficult to build a team around that, but let's say you could, but let's focus on snake drafts. He said, Witt's arguably the best at his position. So now we're using position scarcity here. Managers start with one shortstop, one middle infield to fill. There are five outfield spots to fill. Managers who miss on Acuña can still draft Corbin Carroll, Fernando Tatis, Julio Rodriguez, and Kyle Tucker. Like, what? If you're in a, no, you can't. Like, and they're saying, like, the drop off is, like, not that big, and he's saying the drop off's not that big in the outfield, because if you pass an Acuña, you can still draft, yeah, Julio Rodriguez or Kyle Tucker. Well, first of all, if you're in the first round, you draft the first pick, you're not going to pass on Acuña. So it's like, you know what I mean? This makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't get it. At least if you said, like, Strider, like, you know, make an argument, yeah, for Strider's number one pick. All right, sure, like, fine. But the whole Witt thing, it makes no sense. I don't know.
This makes no sense. We shouldn't, like, this is, we've already spent too much time on this. Last thing here is, we've got some records, actually. Like I said, I've listened to a few podcasts. I haven't been that, I've removed a lot of podcasts this year from listening, because I want to, like I said, have my own thoughts here. But we had some big records set this week, the last week or two. Mike Kirlin benched with Bubba. They started the podcast, and Kirlin talked for six straight minutes, and Bubba did not interrupt him about his website. 6 minutes, like, Bubba, like, there were points where Kirlin paused, Bubba didn't even say anything. He just let, like, I think Bubba might have fallen asleep during Kirlin talking. But if you go listen to the Kirlin on the Bubba podcast, near the beginning, I think from the 2 to 8 minute mark, he just did not stop. It was amazing. And then also Rob on the launch angle, he had a 6 minute introduction. So that's about, like, promotional stuff and, like, talking about what they're going to talk about later, just like sort of like a less useful version of what they talked about for 6 minutes. So that was both good, both, like, very good records of, like, a lot of talking. But let's get into what we said we're going to talk about, which is Seattle Mariners catchers. So let's talk about that. Cal Raleigh.
Yep. Yeah. Really, really excited to be a part of Catcher Week here.
Catcher Month. It's Catcher Month.
No, so I mean, just like this doesn't require anything more than like two sentences, but like Cal Raleigh, I think I was more interested in him before the Garver signing, because I think the Mariners lineup is mediocre enough that, I mean, he's like legitimately their second best player. And so it made sense for him to play every single day. Plus, he's a switch hitter. I mean, the problem now is, and I think Cal's great. And like, you know, one of the nice things about him is like there's a couple of catchers you can say could hit 30 home runs, but like he's actually legitimately done it. The problem now is, well, if the Mariners are going to have Garver, plus if they carry Zavala, then they're going to find a way to play those guys at catcher occasionally as well. So then maybe you rotate Raleigh in through the DH. The problem is, like, Raleigh actually is not that great against left-handed pitchers, even though he's a switch hitter. And even up until the end of the season last year, like, there were times where they batted him seventh. And so, you know, I think that he's probably pretty safe. Like I said, he is legitimately one of their best players and like one of the leaders of the team. So I think he will play. But I mean, I don't think that there's a ton of upside beyond what he did last year, basically, which I mean is great from catcher. I think that in most drafts, there's just a catcher around there that I like better.
Yeah, like catcher's interesting this year. Like Mariners are one of the teams that are using, like, I guess catcher as a DH in Garver. I don't know if you count him as catcher anymore, but I think you're, I guess, a Mariners fan. I'm a Jays fan. I think we are the only two teams that are like using their catchers as like DHs, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, like
Like,
it's actually not a
at
good
least you got
sign.
better, at least you got better ones.
No, I mean the sad thing for the Mariners is that Garver is their largest contract for a free agent hitter in the DePoto era. So like that is the most they have ever paid for a free agent hitter since DePoto took over, and it's 33-year-old Mitch Garver, who, you know, I think is like I can get behind taking him in a draft, but the weird thing about that is like his ADP jumped 30 spots when he signed with the Mariners. And I don't understand that, because what was the thought process before he signed? Where was he going to sign? This was like maybe one of the worst spots that he could end up, just from a park and lineup context perspective. Like you could probably imagine something worse, but it's not great. And so then, you know, as soon as I would think about taking him, he jumped two rounds. So I don't know.
It's like the free agents are just always undervalued by some sort of like bias. But yeah, let's really talk about Sebi Zavala. That's really what, like, it's catcher month on Beat the Shift. We need to talk about Zavala. Just kidding. But in seriousness, any interest in Harry Ford in the DCs? I've taken him.
Man, I don't know. I don't think there's such a thing as a wasted pick in the 50th round of a DC, but a 20-year-old catcher with like four guys ahead of him on the depth chart who can play catcher is just like you got to have a lot of things go right, and then, you know, I don't know.
I think he's gonna be a trendy pick in 2025 drafts.
Yeah, I could see that absolutely.
I think he's gonna be like what a Bo Naylor was last year, next
Yeah.
year. Anyways, but I don't know, there's an outside chance he does like a Juan Soto type thing. It's interesting. Roster Resource has Garver batting third, Raleigh batting fourth, which is weak lineup if you have that. But Kurland has Raleigh batting third and Garver fourth against right-handed pitchers. So that tells me two things. It tells me that Kurland is superior in these roster settings, predicting lineups, because he's going into more detail. But does this matter at all to
Oh, of
you?
course, yeah. Trust Kurland. Because I always trust Kurland. Yes.
All right, I got a challenge for you for the rest of this podcast, actually. I don't think we might not be able to do it because we're talking about your player shares from last year. But aside from that, I think we do the rest of this podcast without naming a single player name.
It'd be a terrible podcast.
Know, we could. We could. All right. Well, we got our hold on a second. We got our trivia segment. This is I promised a trivia segment at the beginning of the podcast, and let's go. Okay, I played that twice just in case it didn't come up. But this is our trivia of the week. We have Paul Spohr's pitching rankings on Fangraphs. So the trivia question is, does he have, who is he ranked higher between these two pitchers? And I'm going to give you the pitcher name now. Who does he have ranked higher? Jack Flaherty or Nick Pivetta?
Is it Flaherty? He has Flaherty ranked higher?
Yeah, you're correct. You've won the Ruven Guy Trivia of the week. What? Okay. Congratulations, Todd. All right, that's it for that. What the hell was that? Why did that pop up in the middle of the podcast? It's weird. What's the point of that? I don't know. Anyways, Draft Champions Leagues. How many 150s and 400s are you doing? Are there any difference between the 150s and the 400s?
There's definitely a difference. I tried to do 9 of the 150s and then a 6-pack of the 400s. I'll start the 150s earlier because there's like better diversity in the people who are actually doing those drafts. The early 400s, it's kind of like the same group over and over again, you know? So yep. I want to kind of mix those up a little bit. I mean,
no more Seymour for the last 2 years.
Never heard of it. I mean, the nice thing, honestly, about the 400s is there is like a lot more diversity and movement away from the ADP, and a lot more guys who are willing to jump players. And, you know, that can work to your advantage or disadvantage, you know, as you go. But I think that the way that I try to kind of approach drafts and having, you know, like I said, if you have 15 total DCs, then I'm less concerned if a guy that I really like gets jumped in ADP in that draft, because I'll just wait till the next one to take that guy, right? Yeah. And so then it can kind of lead to other guys falling that, you know, maybe at their ADP you wouldn't have that much interest, but then like they fall a couple of rounds and all of a sudden like you've got the max pick on that guy and it becomes a lot more interesting. And it's a sort of a useful way to also help kind of diversify the player shares, right? Especially towards the top of the draft. I mean, that's kind of the way that I try to approach it. But you know, I don't even know. I wouldn't even say necessarily that like the 400 DCs are really sharper than the 150 DCs. I do think the 400 DCs, people are much more confident in their abilities, right? And
that makes sense.
Like we'll not milk the clock a lot of times, right? They'll just like, you know, we'll hammer out picks in a 400 DC a lot quicker than the 150s, where you get a couple people who are either indecisive or you know, it's their first draft of the year or whatever, and it just, they move a lot slower. So that's the biggest difference you see between them. But I don't actually know that there's that much of a difference. Like when I look at the overall standings or whatever, how my 400 teams do relative to my 150s, it all kind of seems to be mixed together and there's not one that does better than the other.
Yeah. I think I've noticed that, like just looking at the results. I did a DC plus metric. Just because I saw someone else did it when they're like basically scouting the drafts to see if there's like bad opponents and stuff like that. And oh, by the way, you call the 400s the $400 leagues. I call the 400s the 4-hour 150s. So those are my 400s.
4-hour 150s.
Those are the ones I'm scouting. But you had a 133% DC plus, which is the third best player to do 10 or more DCs. So like you and I forget. I know Seth Trackman was one of the other guys. It was really good.
Is this like Stuff Plus where 100 is average, or is
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, 100 would be average. And
so 133 is not average. Yeah.
No, you're well above average. 133 actually. It's like if you filter it for three or more DCs, so it would include more people. Second best player is Kevork. So give shout out to Kevork. If you look at it, no shit. That's what it is. That's the second place player. Okay. So
who's number one? You didn't say who number one was.
Number one, it was not somebody that I know super well. I'll tell you right now. His name is Brian Bellinger. He played four leagues. He had a 144 stuff plus. Kevork was second. Clark Olsen was third. Cerebro was fourth.
Is this like a Jeremiah Estrada situation? Or
well, in Kevork's case, I think it might be, but I think maybe Cerebro and Clark Olsen might be Striders.
Okay, there we go.
But yeah, no, mine was like I was 112. So I was above average, but not as good as you.
But that's pretty good for 50 DCs you did last year, though.
Yeah, it definitely is harder to do well in those. Yeah, Seth was 135, and there's a lot of people in that range, like 133, 135. But anyways, yeah. So Lucas Beery, Nutsin was in there, really high performances. But yeah, let's we're moving on to another segment here. Why does it keep playing? But why is that going on in the middle of a podcast? All right. Are you more of a player analysis person, or are you into roster construction in the DCs?
I think, I don't know. What I would say for DCs is that I've played enough of those now where I at least know what roster construction can work and what is probably not going to work. And then from there, it's more like archetypes of certain players that I'll probably target.
Oh, that's a football term. That's a football term. You can't use that.
Oh no. Is it really? I don't even listen to fantasy football podcasts.
Oh, they love that. They love that word. They love archetype.
Well,
they don't use it properly, but they love it.
So, I mean, there's usually just like a group of guys that I know I'll be interested in those guys. And so I'll kind of build it from there. There's certain players where, like, I think certain players require more of a deep dive than others. You know, there's so much time and, like, ink spilled on a lot of the guys, especially at the top of the draft, right? That just, it's, I think, probably mostly a waste of time to be deep diving a lot of those guys. Like, you know, maybe you really can get an edge in knowing who the first round bust is going to be, but I think that's probably not a great use of time. I mean, honestly, especially for the DCs, like I'll spend most of my time on the player analysis type stuff and deep dives on the guys after like 300 or so, right? Where you have to, like, there's not really any use in even looking at projections for those guys. It's more about like, just start thinking about what is the possibility, like what's the pathway to this guy getting full-time playing time and actually being useful and playable, right? And thinking more about that type of stuff. And it's you know, sometimes it's like player deep dives and player analysis, sometimes it's just like roster analysis, right? Or thinking about the context and then trying to figure out for those guys how they can be useful to your DC team. That's so much different than a fab league, because those guys, like, whatever, you'll fab them in week two and you don't have to worry about it till then. But for a DC, like, those are the only shots you get, right? So I want to know for those guys sort of what my value proposition is for how that guy becomes usable in my lineup, and then kind of go from there.
Right. Bjorn, how did you pop? You just popped in. Where the fuck did you come from?
Yeah, I'm having a really rough day. I have a few minutes here, though, so I wanted to pop on and talk to Todd. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm doing great, Bjorn. You know, I had a question for you.
Sure.
I want to know, did you see, we've spent about 45 minutes on Cal Raleigh. I wanted to see if you, did you see that picture of Cal where he's looking really slim this off season, and I'm kind of worried about his power this year because of how skinny he was.
Well, I think, great question. From what I've been, digging deep into the articles and stuff, it sounds like right now he's ordering a bunch of veggie subs from Subway, but he plans on switching to more of a meat, their meat supplements, faux meat, whatever they have at Subway as the season gets closer. So I think right now he's in sort of the cut phase, I believe is a bodybuilding term. I'm not exactly sure, but he is going to get some more meat in his mouth, and he'll bulk up definitely by the season's start time. So don't worry about that, Todd.
Got it. Great. So switch to the BMTs once the season starts. I like that.
That's some good intel.
Yes. And then I had a question for you, Todd. I heard someone describe themselves earlier today, just on the radio, as being a hardcore MLB fan. And I think, judging by the volume of that you play, you're not really necessarily in a softcore fantasy guy. Would you consider yourself into more of a hardcore fantasy?
Yeah, definitely the more hardcore stuff piques my interest for sure.
All right. Yeah, Zach, I do actually have to go in a couple minutes to talk about, or not to talk about, gosh, I don't even have, I'm just at a loss right now, but to go get a car towed. We're at negative 10 degrees here in the Midwest. But there's a song, and it's called "If You're Happy and You Know It, Clap Your Hands." And you know who could never clap their goddamn hands?
Jim Abbott.
Are these whiners, these
Oh,
MLB
no.
whiners? They're like,
Sorry,
oh,
I thought you were going to say Jim Abbott. I really did.
that's right. That's actually really good. They complain like, oh, the players make too much money and the owners never spend enough money. And then when the owners spend money, it's the Dodgers. Oh, those fucking losers are going to buy a championship. Well, which is it? You want them to spend money? Well, yeah, but then they don't have a farm system and they're buying a championship. It's like, blah, blah, blah. You should be mad at your own owners for not buying the players. And every single time that you go to watch, I live in Wisconsin now, the Brewers or the Pirates or whatever, and you're paying $60 a ticket and $15 a beer, you're telling those owners, just keep shoveling shit into our mouths and we're going to take it. We don't care if you buy free agents. Stop going to the game. If anything, you should be a Dodgers diehard fan. They're doing everything they can to please their fans. So it's just like, people love to complain about the MLB. I actually think Cubs fans would be happier if they never won a World Series, because now it's like, oh, we won a World Series 10 years ago and blah, blah, blah. So did the Royals. And it's just like, no one is ever happy. Everyone loves to be sad in this crazy baseball world. But yeah, that's what I was thinking about today as I was sitting in this bitterly cold weather. Maybe that's just got me in a rough mood because I'm all shriveled up.
Sorry, Brian. I don't know what's going on in our studio, but just our studio. I don't know. We're just using another studio, so I don't know. It just plays randomly. But it was good to see
Yeah.
you. You missed a lot. We talked about the pitcher list article talking about Acuna not being the number one pick. We talked about Kierlin's talking 6 minutes straight on the bench with Bubba. We talked about Jeff Zimmerman's minding the opinions. We talked about the analysts tweeting every pick of their draft. And we're going to get into some of the Todd's drafts and strategy
Yeah, I know.
soon.
I saw Frank was tweeting out his entire draft. I liked your suggestion that he never had to delete a draft because of a tweet, because no one else is on those players, and it, you know, he's got some gold there. But yeah, unfortunately, I do have to head out. That wasn't just a bit, and go get this car taken care of. But Todd, it looks like you're having a great time, and stay warm. It looks like you got a little jacket thing going on there yourself.
Yeah, it's freezing cold here too, but not minus 10, and I don't have to tow a car.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Bjorn just
Well,
likes to he likes to comment on our guest wardrobe from time to time.
yeah. All right. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, see you, Bjorn. So where were we? We talked about roster construction. Guy that is coming on my podcast next week, Chris Reed, he always talks, well, he likes to talk about stacking players like on the same team. Like I remember that 1 year he was all over Bybee and Gavin Williams and Logan Allen, and then he loved the Seattle Mariners guys like Bryce Miller Hancock. Like he was the guy that got me sort of piqued my interest in Bryce Miller last year. Is that a strategy that you like? Not necessarily pitching, but anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes probably makes the most sense for pitching, right? Or places where, because you have to be able to narrow it down to a couple of guys, right? Because so it could be maybe it's center field, right? Maybe there's only two guys on the roster that can play center field. So last year, I saw that with the Astros and was like, all right, I'll take Chaz McCormick, and then Jake Myers goes in like the 42nd round or something. I'll just take both of those guys. One of them at any given point in the season is going to have to be playing center field for the Astros, unless unlikely they make a trade. They obviously weren't going to sign anybody else. So in spots like that, I think it makes sense. You do have to kind of pick your spots, right? Like, I'm not sure that it makes a ton of sense to stack the Rockies' fifth starter pick between all of those guys. Then it's not useful. So you want to kind of see that there's a path there for those guys to be valuable. But I do think it makes sense to correlate your picks together, right? Where, maybe there's obviously less than a 50% chance that one of those guys is actually going to be valuable that late in the draft. But if you pick both of them, then the value to you is, well, the odds are that one of them will be valuable at some point during the year. And it's obviously no guarantee, but at least gives you a little bit of an avenue towards having that roster spot or those two roster spots be valuable at some point during the year.
Yeah, that makes sense. You got any guys in mind this year? You got any like we called it the Monopoly board.
The
Get all the
Monopoly
powder
board.
blues of like whatever, right? Last year, Mariners, Bryce Miller, Hancock. No one was getting Woo. No one drafted him. But
Yeah, which is, I mean, those are crazy to think back on, right? That nobody was even drafting a guy like Brian Woo. I mean, I think that there's like maybe for these Orioles minor league pitchers that there's a couple of guys there where the Orioles have a combination of being a really good team with like a really shaky back end of their rotation and kind of a reputation now of really good pitcher development, where, I can look at a couple of those guys and say, well, I wouldn't mind having a couple of them on my team because at some point they're going to have to call one of these guys up, even if they, over the course of the offseason, even if they end up trading for a Cease or somebody else, like they're just not going to spend in free agency. And so, those guys, I think, will pitch at some point this year. Whether, will they be good? I don't know. But I mean, you're spending like a 40 something round pick on those types of guys.
yeah, that makes sense. Catcher, the people, you know what? It's catcher week, so let's talk more about catcher. We haven't heard enough about this shit. I'm probably asking the same thing that everyone else has asked like 7 or 8 times that you've heard, but catcher's so deep. Where do you see the pockets of value here? But like, where do you want to shop with catcher? Like, there's a relative discount this year in the JTR Will Smith range. Like, they're going way later, and they're like you can include like Adley in that as well. But then there's a pocket of catchers in round 9 through 11 that I like a lot too. But the thing with that, and I've been in a lot of DCs, is the catcher run is fast, but it's predictable. So I saw someone tweet, Mark Rodd, I think he was on the pod with us last year. What's his Twitter handle? Khaki Birds, I think it is. But he said that he's like, boy, like the catcher run goes quick, like in DCs. Like I do like that area, but like, it's predictable. Basically, like if you're like anywhere near like the 10, 11 turn, like it's gonna run out there. So you gotta draw on the line in the sand. You gotta know what the opportunity cost is. Do you like the other players in that range? Later on, like there is still value in with some catchers, perhaps. Like there's some catchers I like later on too. It's like a matter of opportunity cost. Where are you looking to shop right now in this draft season?
I mean, isn't it crazy this year how for like the first tier of closers and then that tier of catchers, it's like so predictable exactly when the run is going to start for each of those. I mean, I think my preference would be to just kind of plan that out ahead of time and be ready for it and just take one of those guys at the same time that everybody else is taking one. and then sort of find my, you know, whatever, my values in different spots. Because, you know, I don't know, like, is it, do you think it's possible that it's a, like, is it possibly just a groupthink thing for this, like, round 9 to 11 catcher thing, that all these guys are really valuable and that there actually are some that are quite a bit better picks than others? Or do you think they're, like, roughly the same?
Are you talking catchers here or close?
Yeah, let's okay. focus on catchers. The catchers. Catchers,
in terms of my skill set in analyzing the catchers, I think they're roughly the same. I don't think I have the capability to tell you. I do have an inclination to draft one over the other for sure. Like, I have my preferences, but I think that it's not worth it. Like, if I'm on the turn and like I'm pick like 11 and there's like four or three people between me and there's three or four of them left, you know, I'm like, oh, I'll just take the player I want and get the catcher that falls. That's my,
yeah.
Do I think there's going to be enough catchers left? And then if right. the answer is yes, I'll wait. If the answer is no, I'll take my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. Like, I don't love it. If we're past round 11, I don't have a catcher yet in a DC specifically, because that's one of those spots where like, there is no backfilling, like maybe worse than any other position. There's no guy that you're taking after like round 35. They're all going to be darts, right? And so you're like, it's a hope and a prayer at that point. And so I'd really rather not waste those picks later on. I'd rather just have that catcher, both of those catcher spots filled by the time we get to round 11. But I mean, you know, as Mark astutely pointed out, if you're at the turn, then you could easily miss out if you're not aggressive on the guy that you like best of that tier.
No, absolutely. Now, I don't know if you do auctions or not. Do you do any auctions?
I've not done any auctions, but I mean, I see the question here and I kind of dig it. So you were thinking specifically of the Henry Davis question in auctions, right?
Well, yeah, like I alluded to there being value later on after that round 9 through 11 range. Like, Henry Davis is one of those players, like, I think we assume he's going to get catcher. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion either that he gets catcher eligibility. Like, they could easily add a catcher. And maybe he gets it, like, during the season in June, potentially. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion he gets catcher eligibility after 2 weeks at this point of the offseason. But that said, like, there's other catchers I like in that range. I guess we've lost the challenge of talking about player names anyways, but is it worth the draft cost? Like, he's moving up in these drafts. Is it worth it to, like, in a DC it's different. So it's like, okay, you can throw him on your bench, but you just realize that, like, if you draft him in round whatever, he's going to your bench probably, assuming you draft him to their outfield, and then you're going to be stuck with a pretty shitty catcher for 2 weeks, basically. And you're going to be drafting your next catcher in like round 28 or 30 and whatever. That's your backup catcher, but you're going to use him as your primary catcher until Henry Davis gets his eligibility, which is a little bit easier. But what I've noticed in these auctions, and I've been in three auctions so far, Henry Davis goes between like $3 and $5 in these auctions. However, like, what I'm also seeing is like Garver and Washington guy, what's his name?
Yeah, Kyber Ruiz.
Yeah, Kyber Ruiz. Like, they're $7. Like, I've seen Francisco Alvarez $8. I've gotten Perez for $8, Garver for $6 or $7. So I'm like, okay, in an auction, you can only draft like your starting lineup in the auction, and then you fill out your reserves. So if you're taking Henry Davis in the auction, you do also have to take two catchers because you got to fill your roster. So, like, you're burning, like, say, like, at best case, your utility spot, worst case, an outfield spot. And that's going to preclude you from getting another $1 outfielder that could be really good that you like. And then you're not going to be able to get that. Like, the opportunity cost is, say, like, Tommy Pham. Let's say you think Tommy Pham's like a $5 player, just as an example. You're not going to get him because Henry Davis is stuck in your lineup until you go into the reserve rounds and get yourself another outfielder to fill in for Henry Davis, or use Henry Davis. So I think this, like, you're if Henry Davis cost a buck or $2, okay, that maybe that might be worth it. But you're paying like almost as much as like say like Campusano or like close to Garver. You might as well just buy the catcher, in my opinion, unless you think Henry Davis is going to be like really, really good player and he's going to be like at the levels of like say like a Sal Perez or something like that. But like in the auctions, it like I thought to myself, I'm like, okay, yeah, Henry Davis, cool guy to target, but just like the math just isn't working for me in these auctions.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like just not valuing the roster spot at all. Exactly. And I don't know how you quantify that, but it's definitely worth something. And man, it requires like really optimistic view of Davis, who I like, but who it'd be really hard to justify taking for more than a buck in an auction.
Yeah, I agree. Like last year, like Shea Langeliers, he was going for like in auctions, he was going for like a buck or two, sometimes in the reserve rounds, rarely in the reserve rounds. Usually he was taken, but like his Henry Davis could be better than him. Yeah, probably. But just looking at the comparative cost, like in DC's, Langeliers was what, like a 18th round pick, but we knew he was going to be a catcher. We knew he was going to get that eligibility. Henry Davis, I think there's still, in my mind, is still that little question. So it's a lot of different, I guess, like angles to think about here. But I don't know. I'd say like in a draft champions, I think he's definitely worth it at a certain point. In an auction, I think I'm probably not going to be getting it. Relief pitcher looks like it's going later. You alluded to that a little bit. I think it's because Phil DeSoto is not doing any DC so far, and everyone's just not copying him because he was the guy. Once he started taking the two early relief pitchers, everyone started copying that year, and then it sort of seemed to be that's the thing to do. People can do that, but you see a lot of other good players like I'm just describing some styles like Steve Weimer, Mike Mager, like those are like seasoned DC guys, and I think they're very methodical, and I usually see them take one closer in the first 10 rounds, and then they try to build their team around that. Now, it seems like the relief pitcher market's going a little bit later. They're a little bit less costly this year.
Yeah, because there's no like second rounders, right?
Right.
I mean, last year you'd see like either Clase or Diaz before he was hurt, sneaking in to that 2-3 turn, especially. I think it's probably just because there's more of them after the top couple that people are okay getting is their RP1, and maybe that's like, you know, maybe it's fool's gold in some ways, but it's almost certainly because last year, like that whole group was the majority of them were successful, right, and held their jobs the entire year. Mm-hmm. And so sort of like, you know, it's almost counterintuitive, but it's like there's more of them, you know, maybe 15 or so of them that you trust, and so the top ones actually like last a little longer because you're like, well, you know, at the next round, I can easily get the guy at the back end of that I think is roughly the same to the top end. So that's, I think, probably why it's happening. I still think those guys are super valuable in DCs to have, especially. But part of that is my preference to not be taking a bunch of random relievers in round 35, 40, 45 at this point.
Okay. Was it you that said to me that you want to talk about this year's Mason Miller, a guy that didn't get drafted at all in any DC?
Yeah, you want to do it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, so last year I came to you with the idea of this year's Ellerys Montero, right?
And we'll do that next too.
Yeah, I mean, the idea was to like pick a guy who would be useful exactly once all year, right? And I got to say, like, the segment was a disaster, right? Because I picked CES, who ended up being like way more useful than that. He was way too good for it. Yeah. And Nikolai picked Wallner, who was also really good, like way too good for the award. I think Mark was probably the only one who like understood the assignment and picked Sean Bouchard, who was hurt all year and then hit four home runs in the last week of the season.
Yeah, that was perfect. He understood it.
So this time around, I thought maybe do something like this year's Mason Miller, right? Which is a guy who like shows up who almost nobody has ever heard of, who's definitely not getting drafted, who has like barely pitched the last 4 years, but who will pop up in the middle of the season, have like a ridiculous stuff plus and be like a borderline triple digit fab bid and then immediately either get hurt or just be completely useless. All right, so I mentioned the Orioles pitchers earlier. There's this guy for the Orioles named Seth Johnson. Have you heard of Seth Johnson?
I have.
He's a former Rays prospect. He was in the trade for Trey Mancini, Jose Siri. And the guy's pitched like 140 innings in the past 4 years because of injury and COVID and various other things. But he's already 25 years old. Every single scouting report says he's got electric stuff when he's healthy. They all said the exact same thing. And I actually, I don't know how relevant it is, but I think it's really interesting that there's this guy, his name is Luke Seiler, who tweeted like nonstop about Seth Johnson back in like 2018, 2019, before he even got drafted by the Orioles. And the Orioles immediately hired this guy to be part of their scouting department and then traded for Johnson. Johnson was drafted by the Rays and then the Orioles traded for him after they brought in this guy, this like random dude from Twitter. So, you know, I don't know. I'm guessing that he shows up at some point this year, is electric, and then becomes immediately useless.
Right on. I think that's a good call. I don't know if I want to. I have a couple guys that aren't even the player pool yet that I might want to add in. I don't know if I want to say them, though. I'm just not going to. I'll be annoyed. I'll be too annoyed. I'll tell you who they are, though, later. So you talked about this year's Ellie Heroes Montero last year, and you said it was CES, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So do you want to
All right. I don't know.
What the hell? Okay, sorry. So yeah, do you have a guy for this year?
I mean, for the same criteria as last year, I think it's got to be.
All right,
because that's a guy.
Fuck you. We're deleting this. This is getting bleeped out. But don't say. Okay, you can keep talking, but don't say his name again because I don't have to do a lot of bleeping.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, right. I think the point is he's probably not going to be good or useful or up this year. But if he is, you'll know immediately when to put him in the lineup. And I think that it's at least feasible to like look at that roster and find a path to him being in the majors and playing basically every day.
Yeah. Did you take him or did I take him in that draft we did?
You took him in our draft together because I was already loaded up at the position, but I liked the pick.
Thanks. Yeah, I like the pick. I like your call. Yeah, no, I've taken him in a couple drafts. But yeah, good player. So who's this year's Bryce Miller? These are really bad questions. people love these questions. It's terrible.
It was going to be really hard to do this whole thing without naming any player names.
Yeah, it would. The player that wasn't really being drafted, or like he could be undrafted like at this time, but then by the February and March rolled around, like he was always being drafted. Like, you know, like I think for him, he was about like early round 40s.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that there's like a perfect name. In terms of the profile, like there's a guy from the Mets, Christian Scott, who kind of reminds me of Bryce Miller. He goes a lot earlier than Miller did last year. Like
everyone's going earlier. All these prospects are going earlier.
Yeah, so maybe it's a reaction to that. But he feels like, I mean, it's similar profile in terms of like college reliever who then got into an organization that like people are starting to say that the Mets like minor league pitching coordinators are actually really good at this pitch shape stuff, right? Which is something that the Mariners do really well and like optimizing fastballs. Mm-hmm. I think Christian Scott is a guy who's kind of like that. And he's also old enough now at this point, like he's 24 years old, that it wouldn't make sense for him to spend the entire year in the minors. Though, you know, I guess the problem is the Mets have like 10 guys who are all like fine-ish, right, ahead of him. So, you know,
Vasil is I think one of them.
Yeah. And even beyond that, like if Severino gets hurt, who's to say that they don't throw like Tyler McGill again or Lucchesi or Jose Buteau, like any of those guys as well. So it's like there's a lot of roadblocks there, but I think he's like a similar quality pitcher and a similar profile that, if he found his way to the majors, could easily be as good as Bryce Miller was last year.
All right, I got. Do you want to hear mine? The guy that's going pretty late in these drafts could move up in like February and March.
Give it to
So,
me. Yeah.
to player, he last pitched for the Los Angeles Dodgers. His name is Trevor Bauer. Don't know if
Never
you've heard
heard
of
of him. Is
him.
he
Yeah, he's going quite late now, but I think he could pick up some steam depending on the news that comes out. So he's my pick. He's this year's Bryce Miller.
This year's I see the parallels.
Yeah. So that was a segment that we call Meet the Millers. My next question to you is, well, a comment. It's going to be players out of options. And I want to see if any of these players tickle your brain. Okay. All right. So I'm going to give you a list. I'm going to run through them and you can tell me which ones you think are interesting. Basically, players on the on, like that I feel they're on the roster bubble that could go to a different team or could get a role on that team. Sixto Sanchez, Jose Barrero, Joe Adell, Elijah Montero, Jermaine Jones, Ryland Bannon, Ronzi Contreras, Oscar Mercado, Jake Groom, Luis Patino, Joey Bart, Luis Garcia, Nationals, Kai Boone, Rainey, Otto Lopez, Ernie Clement, Miguel Andujar, Sean Newcomb, Kyle Muller, Malazovic on the Twins, AJ Alexi, Willie Calhoun, Garrett Hampson, Esteban Florio, Davey Garcia, Tucker Davidson, Jorge Mateo, Ramon Urias.
I mean, any of the pitchers, if they got traded, you could maybe see it. Like Ronzi Contreras isn't even that old, and he was a really good prospect. And maybe the Pirates just suck at developing him or whatever, So if he got traded and somebody else could figure out a way to work their magic, then maybe that would be interesting. I think probably the most interesting of these guys have already been traded, right? Because it's just not,
Patino.
yeah, like, yeah. And so then maybe they like can spend an entire off season trying to fix whatever wasn't working. This late, it's kind of hard to
Davey
figure.
Garcia is on the White Sox, isn't he? I think. Did I look at that properly? Did he somehow end up in
He
the?
is,
Yeah, he
yes,
ended up on
you're
the. I didn't
right.
even know that
You're right.
until I looked
You're
at
right.
that today. So like,
So
they
maybe,
suck. They suck.
it's you can certainly see him at like starting games for them, whether or not he'll be good. Like it's kind of it's like all of these guys, it's a little bit of a leap of faith that they'll figure something out. But with pitchers, like how often does that happen? It happens all the time with these guys,
Okay,
picking a new pitching coach or whatever.
he can be my next year's Mason Miller, sure. Okay.
Okay, I like that.
Players like Christopher Sanchez and Edward Cabrera, they're out of options. Does that do anything in terms of increasing their value? Because like they can't demote them, get a bigger leash.
Maybe a little bit like margin, like at the margins, but the like Christopher Sanchez is already going kind of high, right?
Yeah.
So you would hope that any of your picks in the top 300 have a pretty small chance of being demoted. Maybe there's some guys you can think of who are higher chances than others, but I don't know. I feel like I'd be more interested in the guys after 400 or whatever that have to play.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, speaking of that, after 500, I have this question here. Do you want to give two, like, couple players, pitchers or hitters, maybe one of each, if you want two of each, that you like after post 500 that should be going a lot earlier? If you
Man,
don't want
haven't
to,
I given out?
I wouldn't if I were you.
I've given out a lot of my names. I don't know. I think
No,
one
I
guy.
wouldn't if I were you. I don't think I want you to, but.
I don't know. Like one guy that I'm kind of interested in, who I'm not even necessarily saying he's a great pick, but like Jack Leiter with the Rangers, right? Who has been absolutely terrible. Like, he's walked everyone since he's been drafted. But in the middle of last season, the Rangers put him on the development list. And then he came back basically to work on his mechanics. He came back with like completely new mechanics and was not terrible. I wouldn't even say he was great, but he was like suddenly not walking everybody. And that is like one team where you can look at their rotation and it's like injuries all over the place, right? So like, you know, sure, in theory, by midseason, DeGrom will be back, or like Tyler Mahle will be back, or
another guy too.
Eovaldi won't be hurt, but like, you know, there's a pathway there for Leiter to pitch this year in the majors. I would say it's like maybe a 5% chance or 10% chance that they actually fixed anything, but I'm certain that they want him pitching in the majors, and that if he's pitching well, that they'll bring him up. It's just a question of like, you know, is it fixed, or does he, like his first game at AAA this year, does he walk six guys and then there's basically no hope?
Right on. Anyone else, or that's, I think that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, that's good. Okay. Now, how does the first three rounds dictate your draft, if at all? Can you build your team around any start, or can you pivot? Are you looking to do a specific thing in those rounds?
I feel more comfortable doing it the more drafts that I do, because then I feel like I've got guys basically in every round that I know if I need a position or can make stuff up, that I feel a lot better about it. Early on, in early drafts, it's a little more uncomfortable. So, you know, I'll do the thing that everybody does, right? Take a power speed guy, take a starting pitcher, take a reliever. Like, you can sort of see the same basic building blocks for half the teams in a league. As I do more and more of them, I get more comfortable with like where I could make up ground if I need to. And so then it's a lot about like almost taking different guys in the early rounds, because I don't want to have the same guy on every single team, the same first rounder on every single team, right?
Yeah. No, you got to diversify a bit in the first couple of rounds. What about the first 10 rounds? Like, what do you want your team to look like? How many starting pitchers do you have? Are you methodical like that? Do you want a certain number of starting pitchers and a certain number of relief pitchers in the first 10 rounds?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying you have to do it this way, but I feel a lot more comfortable if I've got my two closers and my two catchers by like round 11, because then at that point, like all of the guys that I take from round 35 on, I can basically take shots on guys I think are actually interesting or good, rather than taking shots on, like, you know, like I said, there's been way too many relievers in the past that I've taken in rounds 40 through 50, just because I knew they were going to pitch in the majors and they were middle relievers, and like maybe you could dream that they could be closers. But like, I think that's a lot of times just a waste of a pick for me personally. So I'd rather have those guys up top. And then I've got a lot of guys that I'm interested in, you know, starting pitching and outfield are examples of positions where I feel more comfortable just kind of building after that first 10 rounds. But, you know, I wouldn't say that anybody, that you have to do it that way. It's just sort of how I like building my teams.
If I have two closers in the first like seven rounds, I'm usually not even looking at a reliever. I'm not really looking to add many relievers in the reserve rounds. Like, I might take a shot on somebody in round 24, 25 after I've built my starting roster that I think is really like, that has a really good chance of being relevant. But I'm not looking to draft any more relief pitchers if I have two studs in the first two rounds, and I might add maybe one or two the rest of the draft.
Yeah, I would love it if the NFBC would add a little tool to the draft room that was like an anti-queue or like a block list or something, where I took two relievers in the first seven rounds. Now all of these middle relievers just get out of my, like, I don't even want to see you. Like, just go away. Get out of the draft room.
You know what Derek would say? He'd say, this is not supposed to be easy.
It's not, yeah. Fantasy. Well, then why do they put the ADP in the draft room?
Exactly. I would love for them to get rid of the ADP, because I did all those drafts at the beginning because no ADP, such an edge. They should get rid of ADP. Like, I agree.
Now, as soon as a guy has a season-ending injury, within like 5 minutes, he's at the bottom of the draft room.
Yeah. They should penalize the auto drafters. I agree. They shouldn't touch it. They should make it alphabetical order. What have you identified that you believe to be a key to success this year that was not last year a key, or at least not identified last year?
It's got to be, like we sort of mentioned it, but it's got to be the rookie pitchers and like how quickly those guys are coming up. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was like for me a blind spot last year, where I would look at a guy and be like, well, he's not on the 40 man and he's only pitched a couple games at Double A. Like, there's just no way he's coming up this year. And I think the landscape has changed so much that like teams know so much about these guys now, in terms of like they optimize their pitch shapes, they know exactly how all of that stuff will play against major leaguers, and so they don't actually need to see guys even pitch in Triple A at all. They can bring them up once they're ready, right? And so, you know, I think honestly, like, if I've heard people suggest that last year was kind of an anomaly for the rookie pitchers, and I don't know that I'd buy that. I think that may actually be like the new normal, where you just have a ton of rookie pitchers coming up almost every year. Like, you know, maybe just because you haven't heard the names before doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't these guys, like, they're pumping these guys out every year. I mean, and not all of them are useful, but a lot of them, certainly a lot more of them are useful now than I can ever remember them being, especially in DCs ever before.
Right. Last question for you. I always say it's, you spend more time reviewing your mistakes and victory lapping your wins, but what's your biggest tactical mistake from last year in DCs?
Those shitty middle relievers. Yeah. So many of them, man. Like I hated myself when I would look at a team and I would be like, all right, for this week's pitchers, I can plug in like Shintaro Fujinami or Griffin Jacks or Jeremiah Estrada, or like, you know, what was I doing taking all of those guys? Like, they were, I think you can convince yourself in theory that like, oh yeah, these, you know, you can win the overall if you just hit on a couple of these guys and they become closers in these later rounds. But God, it really is such a crapshoot. Like, you got to take
recency bias year to year. Steve Mayer won the overall with all those crazy calls and the later rounds with Housley and Felix Bautista.
And when he, I mean, I think it's important to remember, like, when he did that draft, it was like halfway through spring training. And so, you know, at that point, you could actually see those guys pitching and be like, oh, this Yoan Duran guy looks really good. He's worth a pick in round 45. And at least at that point, it was worthwhile. When you're drafting in January, it's like, you know, you can sort of talk yourself into one of these guys, but I think it's a real dart throw.
But what about Jeremiah Estrada Stuff Plus? He was getting drafted again.
Yeah,
you know what's funnier? Because people were saying, oh, like, how do you like drafting Robert Suarez so early? Because when they signed Matsui, and then they signed Sakko. But, like, forget, like, early in this draft season, when it was just Robert Suarez there and they added Estrada, people were drafting Estrada as a spec closer again.
Familiar names, man. That's the hardest thing to ignore in the draft room, is a familiar name. You look at a guy and then you're like, oh, I used to like this guy. Maybe I can talk myself into him again.
Let's draft David Dahl in round 50.
All right, man. What can go wrong?
Well, I got to get going, but thanks for coming on. I think it was great. Hope to not see you in the draft room again, honestly.
Yeah, never again.
Okay, so Todd Hoppe, follow him or don't follow him. Anything to say?
No, hop into my drafts.
Okay. Okay. You gotta go, buddy.
All right. Talk to you later. See you, Zach.
See ya.